This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
I am Ethan Sykes. I'm 12 years old, and this is George Sykes, my brother.
Hello.
And this is our Hay Festival.
Festival is about reading.
It's like a festival of books. It's only called Hay Festival because it's in the town of Hay on Wye. It is definitely not anything to do with farming. This is Hay Fever and it's the kids' part of Hay.
And we're going to go and show you the book sanctuary and also some of the play area that they have actually inside.
Books. There are like a few pictures, comfy sofas, and there's some books, obviously, to read.
Books! The Wiggly Worms is over here, and it's sort of like a garden, and they've got some strawberry plants over there. They have bowls of worm.
Well, we're just about to enter the rainforest pod now.
He driving. Quite good. Jaguar.
Some kind of snake. It's pretty good for kids and grown-ups.
Hello, I'm Jarton Poskett, and I write a series of books called Murderous Mass. I've been doing it for about 12 years now. In fact, I think the 13th or 14th just come out. I've lost count. It's not very good for a mass author, is it? Anyway, I've got something to make you think about. Have a go at this. You've got a battery and a games machine. A games machine that needs a battery. You buy them together, and they cost £101. But the machine costs £100 more than the battery. The question is, how much did the battery cost? And let me tell you, the battery does not cost £1.
Oh my goodness, I'm not sure I could do that, Julie. I don't particularly want to make a fool of myself in public either, could you, as children's books editor?
No, the reason I'm the children's book editor is I can't do maths questions. I know it's going to be a trick, and I know lots of children will be able to work it out very quickly.
Well, Ethan and George have already given us a tour of their favourite bits of the site. But Julia, run us through the headlines of the Hay Fever Festival.
Well, the headlines probably are the very big name authors, and there's Jacqueline Wilson, who is not only able to hold a huge audience in the tent, but also can hold them for 7 hours afterwards doing signing sessions, and actually has the, I think, world record, certainly the British record as a signer. The big sessions are a unique opportunity for children to hear some of their favourite authors. But what's lovely is that the smaller sessions give them the chance to hear authors they may not know so well and be introduced to new writers, and I think that's one of the wonderful things.
And of course we launch our Children's Fiction Prize at Hay, and that's connected with the Young Critics Prize, which we very much hope people will be joining. Can you just talk us through that a little bit?
Well, it's great to have the opportunity to unveil the 8 books on the long list for the Children's Book Prize here at Hay, and we've got a wonderful list. It's always a wonderful list, but this year it's a particularly wonderful list because it's got a lot of books for younger readers. There's been a trend in children's books to be going more and more into crossover novels or teenage fiction, but what's nice is we've got books for 8, 9, 10-year-old readers, who I think are the kind of core of the children's book world, really. You've got to get started reading then. So we've got well-known authors like Michelle Paver and Maurice Gleitzman and Marcus Sedgwick, but we've also got absolute newcomers like Gregory Hughes, whose very first novel is one of the books on our long list.
And of course, it's not all about books. There are all sorts of fun activities going on around. I just saw an opera singer walking past, presumably en route to the little condensed opera that happens every day.
Well, I think the thing is, people have begun to realise over the years that children have an amazing experience here, because it's not just the book stuff. There's fantastic opportunities for them to do creative work. There's filmmaking, there's creative writing, there's robotics, and there's the lovely garden to play. And there is, it's just a great place to bring your children. And you can either enjoy, I've just done an event now which was adults and children together, and that's very nice because you can find out what they're reading and what they're thinking about their writing and all of that. Or, dare I say, you can even put your children in an event and go off and do your own thing. So I think Hay's book really become a place for families. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that there's now so much laid on is partly the result of there being such big attendance for the children's events.
price on your strawberry today?
We're just about to go into our second event of the day. It's a cookery lesson.
Welcome. Easy peasy. Cookery school.
We're making mini muffins. Now I'm beating the milk and cream. So far, we've chopped our strawberries and added the demerara sugar.
Can I stir that?
Get your own fork. Start stirring.
So,
we're always fighting like brothers do, and I just get the satisfaction out of telling him he's under sentence of execution.
And I usually kick him in the shins or I go on strike.
I think that means they're
ready. I'm tasting them now and they are delicious. Mum, you'd have my last one if you want.
But they left me one! You've eaten six cookies.
Now, beside the fun and the frolics, some big questions are being asked this year. I went to William Nicholson's event. He's the screenwriter of Gladiator, but has also become well known as a writer of novels for children, and his new book, Rich and Mad, is about falling in love for the first time. So he's a best-selling author, but this book has attracted attention for rather different reasons. It includes an explicit sex scene between teenagers.
I've got a problem, because on the whole, parents control kids' reading. Kids don't have money of their own to go out and buy. Will teachers be nervous about this and feel that it's inappropriate for me to offer a book that tells very positively of two teenagers making love? In fact, when I was promoting the book a month ago and I was travelling from school to school talking about it, I was due to speak in a school in Manchester, and The day before I was due to speak, the head of the English department had read the book and strongly approved of it. But the day before I arrived, the head teacher read the book. And she said, "I'm sorry, we cannot have this author in the school."
So, Julia, what do you think about this book? Do you think he's gone beyond the bounds of what a children's writer should do?
No, of course not. We had all this with Judy Blume and Forever, you know, 30 years ago when she did her first sex scene. It's incredibly important. Where are children going to find out, except in a responsible place like a book? They're going to know more about sex than their teachers or parents or head teachers can believe possible. And actually, children's books have always played an incredibly moral and central role in informing children in a calm and unsensational way about whether it's sex, violence, racism, all the big issues.
But there was one point that came out of my chats with some of the children who'd actually been in the session, which is that the characters in the novel are 17, but most of the audience were 13 or 14.
All right, so they know that sex is round the corner. It's something they're going to want to know about. I'd rather they read about it and got a good graphic within a loving context, two perfectly normal teenagers falling in love, going through all the kind of necessary steps to get to the moment when they first have sex. There's nothing unpleasant about it. And of course at 13 they want to know, wouldn't you?
William made the point of that head teacher who actually felt she couldn't allow him to speak in her school, not because she disapproved, just because of what the parents of some of the children
might
say.
Yeah, but I think that schools and librarians have to think about educating the parents. You cannot protect children. They're going to have seen this. Where will they not have heard about sex? They will have heard about sex on every soap they've seen, on every billboard of every newspaper they've seen, in every pop song they've ever heard. You cannot protect children. All you can do is give them information in a responsible and artistic form, and I think William Nicholson does that very well.
And it's also worth saying that actually the sex is only a tiny part of a very responsible discussion of what teenage emotions are like at that very tender and delicate age.
If we have teenage fiction which doesn't reflect the realities of teenage, i.e. if we never can talk about sex or even, dare I say, talk about drugs, then we will put children off reading.
Another event that got everyone talking was the historian Neil Ferguson's. He turned to education.
I thought this afternoon I'd do something a little bit different and talk about a subject that's very dear to my heart, and I imagine dear to the hearts of many of you, and that is the way that history is taught in our schools. I've been doing a little bit of involuntary market research on this subject, and some of what I've found out has really startled me. I want to make clear that it's not the quality of teaching that I'm talking about. It's the content of the history they're taught, the curriculum that they have to use, that I want to criticize today. So if you do history as a teenager in this country, this is history. Henry VIII, Adolf Hitler, and Martin Luther King junior. That's what a huge number leave school knowing about. And I have come to the conclusion that that is not really enough.
I'm Joe Barnard, I'm 14 years old. I'm currently in year 9 and going into GCSEs. I think history should be compulsory because it's, you know, it's a really interesting subject and we should all really know about what happened.
My name's Hannah Murray Pepper, I'm 27, I'm a primary school teacher. I think history is something that kids would love to study much more than they get the chance to, but certainly in the primary curriculum at the moment, the big focus is on literacy and numeracy.
There needs to be more of a variety in terms of when people learn history, and also not just about wars.
Honestly, just World War II, and that is pretty much all I can remember being taught.
American Civil Rights, the Second World War, First World War. Yeah, he's got it pretty covered there, medieval kings.
I'm Alok Jha, science correspondent for The Guardian, and now it's my turn to quiz our Hey Maths whiz kid, Chartan Poskitt. Chartan, now you've this book you've written...
Sorry, I'm laughing. I've not been called a kid for years. Thank you so much. I'm 54
years old. Whiz kid, general. It's an ageless thing,
I think,
isn't it?
We've hardly started and I love this man.
In your book, you talk about the pi personality test. Now, not meat pies, but pi, the number, the ratio of the diameter of a circle to its circumference. Now, it says here, depending on how many digits you can remember, it tells you what kind of person you are. So can you tell me how many digits you can remember of pi? You could probably remember loads.
No, I can remember 5 decimal places, 3.14159, and there I draw the line. Because
so it says here, you're clever without getting silly, you're a cool operator.
Listen, when you write a book, give yourself a good review, for goodness sake. There's no point saying I'm an idiot in my own book, is there?
It's a good call. What do kids think of your book? I mean, how have they responded to it?
It's very pleasing. The main thing that's really chuffed me about it is the different age groups that have taken to it, because it's a beautifully done, colourful book, which is not my work. It's the illustrator, Rob Davis. Beautiful book. And there's like illusions in it which are attractive to any age, you know, weird tricks. But then for kids who want to get engrossed, there's harder stuff and harder stuff. And some of the maths is called a hot brain zone, and it's zoned off, so, you know, you cross into the zone at your own risk. And what's really, really I've enjoyed the fact is the range of people that have come up to me and said, you know, I'm entertained by this. This can be sort of 5-year-olds and it can be their parents. And so that's what's really made me feel proud about it.
Are you quite surprised by the sort of response that some kids might have? I mean, there is some hard stuff in here. It's not going to be an easy read for everyone.
I can do this one, because what happens is, if you take a sort of child who's keen to learn and intelligent and you present the material right, if you start off from the basics, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, and gradually work up, they will follow you and you can take them as far as you like. One of my other murderous maths books, it deals with trigonometry, and this is a book written for 10-year-olds, and kids that have read my books, I get quite a lot of feedback from them. Kids that really like maths, this is their biggest hit. They can do trigonometry, stuff which takes them right past A-level standard. But if you start at the bottom and work up step by step, you can take kids as far as you like.
OK, and so what about the people who might think the maths is the most boring thing in the world, or it's too difficult, they can't do it? Why do you think people get turned off by it, given that in your book it seems quite exciting?
It's kind of a adult perception, is that a lot of kids these days have got a new attitude. It's being taught very differently in schools at the moment, made more interactive, more problem solving, rather than just banging out graphs and times tables. There's a lot more hands-on stuff which engages kids better, so most kids actually are fairly keen. The adults who sort of say I can't do it and I've missed it, generally speaking, it's because somewhere early in the day they missed a couple of maths lessons or something like that, and therefore they never quite caught up, and thereafter it became a mystery to them. And this is something else that's come out of my maths books. I wrote one book purely about arithmetic, how to add, multiply, divide, subtract. And I have a mate who's trying to get onto an Open University course. He borrowed that book, and thanks to that book written for 8-year-olds, he got onto an OU course. And in fact, now I've just published the adult version. It comes out later this year. So it's just because if you've missed a couple of steps early on, you probably are frustrated by it. And that has happened to an awful lot of adults. And it's just worth, if you want to know about maths, go back to the start, give it a chance. Remember, maths is like broccoli. Some people like it, some people hate it, but you've got to have a bit because it's good for you.
I can't top that, can I? I'm going to leave it there.
I I'm Sarah Crown, and I'm in the Guardian's small but perfectly formed garden shed with Mal Peat, author of four novels, most recently Exposure, a fictional football novel for young people based on the plot of Shakespeare's Othello. And Mal, it's actually kind of reductive, isn't it, to say that these are books about football. It certainly doesn't capture the extent of them. They're about fame and love and money and politics and poverty and adolescence and pretty much anything else that you could think of. And so what I really wanted to ask you first was, how do you know that these are books for children?
I don't.
Right. How do your publishers know?
They don't either. We have continuous debates about who in God's name I'm supposed to be writing these things for. There's a bit of me that doesn't believe in teenage fiction at all. I mean, I grew up without any.
What did you read when you were a teenager?
Oh, I went straight from sort of the classics, you know, Treasure Island and Coral Island and all the other islands, and Biggles, and then to comics, and from comics to sort of Ernest Hemingway and Scott Fitzgerald, you know. I mean, like in those days, you just made a major leap. I mean, I'd rather call it sort of transitional fiction. That sounds even more pretentious than young adult, doesn't it? But there is a kind of writing that I think I would have liked to have had when I was a voracious 14, 15, 16-year-old reader, and those books didn't exist. Mm. And really, I'm supplying a retrospective lacuna. But they're also kind of widely read by adults, so it all comes down to where in the bookshop you are.
And the book, as we've touched on, was an adaptation or a revisiting of Othello.
Yeah.
How did that feel, taking on Shakespeare? That must have been kind of daunting.
Well, he's well dead, so there was no suing involved. I didn't have to be mindful of that. That was a kind of coincidental thing. My first thinking about this book was to do with Posh and Becks. It was about the Beckhams.
Yes, the two main characters bear a pretty unmissable.
Yeah, and there are various sort of hints in the book about shirt numbers, and there are shops.
Sarongs, there's a sarong moment.
The sarong scandal, yes, and there's a supermarket called Becker's. And the book started because I just started reading one of those scandals to do with the Beckhams and thought it might be just fun to elevate them to a kind of Shakespearean tragic level, just to see if that would work, just as a kind of mad challenge.
And you said that obviously you're not worried about Shakespeare suing from beyond the grave. Were you ever concerned that Becks might?
No, not really. I think I'm way below the horizon of interest, really. No, and in fact, you know, the book is entirely sympathetic.
And one of the characters, probably the best known character from Othello, is Iago, the motiveless baddie, who is transformed into Diego, Otello's agent in your version of the story. He must have been a difficult person to tackle because, as you know, one of the most famous things about the Shakespeare's version of this story is that nobody knows why he does what he does. Why do you think he did it?
I almost precisely equal the motivation that Shakespeare gives, because actually, in the play, his evil energy is far in excess of anything that would be justified by that level of resentment. You know, there are hints that he's motivated by some kind of global disdain for fly-by-night celebrities and all that kind of stuff, and an absence of real heroes in the world. But that's kind of spurious, you know. The truth about Diego, as about Iago, is that it's just the sheer pleasure in the task of destruction, really.
Your book doesn't pull its punches on violence, for example.
Right.
There's a murder at one point. Does it bother you inflicting violence on these characters you've created?
I enjoy doing it. I mean, there was a need for violence. I mean, all writers will seek to justify violence in their work, you know, just as all film directors will, and it's often bullshit, really. Mm. It justifies itself when it works, basically, and the very difficult thing to do as a writer is to sit in a room all by yourself and write this stuff and ask yourself, does this work? I have an editor. I have a wife who's even fiercer. And, you know, I take soundings and I think it's okay. You know, I read writers like Louis de Bernier, you know, and you get to chapters of absolute savagery and you think, would the book be diminished without it? And I'm sometimes inclined to think, no, it wouldn't. You know, I'm not particularly bloodthirsty. And I joking apart, it's always quite godlike to destroy a character, but I do take the murdering quite seriously, really.
This is the third of your novels with the journalist, the sports journalist Paul Fastino, acting as the hook around which everything hangs.
Yeah.
Why does he keep drawing you back?
oh, I don't know, he just won't go away. He keeps wandering into my life, you know, and sort of catching my cigarettes. You know, I didn't really mean to take him very far. I mean, he was a last-minute addition to Keeper.
You said you named him after a bottle of wine.
Yeah, yes. Faustino is a fairly decent Rioja, you know. also a lovely word, and of course, you know, it's Little Faust, which is... I mean, he's a man who makes minor pacts with the devil because he is a journalist.
Can so we expect to see him again?
Oh, God, I don't know. Probably. I mean, I haven't written enough books with him in to kill him yet, I think. Not quite. I think he needs another couple of books before he gets run over or murdered or something.
We're always being told how difficult it is to get boys to read. Mm. And that's something that I'm personally very interested in, as I'm the mother of one. Mm. These are books about football to a certain extent, although football's pretty much a cipher for the other things that are happening in them most of the time. Mm. Are you consciously courting a male audience?
Well,
do girls read your books?
I get more positive feedback from girls than I do from boys, which is great because one of the things I set out to do in Keeper, and I mean, that was my first book. I didn't care, you know, and I thought I would write a football book for girls initially. Although I'm not entirely convinced that it's true that younger boys won't read. They'll either read when they're ready or they'll read stuff that we don't consider literature.
Well, would you have to work out would it be 20
how
you could get
your
if there were
said,
two
battery
which was
pound,
£100 would it be 25 pounds?
Together they cost £101.
The battery would be free and then £1?
99p.
Hello, I'm Jarton Poskett, and if you were listening earlier, you'll have heard my little question about the battery in the games machine. Together they cost £101, but the games machine costs £100 more than the battery. The question I asked is, what did the battery cost? You might have said the battery costs a pound and the game machine £100, but that's not the right answer.
The battery would be free in
£99.
The answer is, the games machine has to cost £100.50, then the battery costs 50p. That way, the two of them together add up to £101, and yet the games machine still costs £100 more than the battery. It's the only answer that works. So if you got it right, give yourself a big hug. Well done.
No, I don't understand.
That's confusing.
Yeah, that doesn't kind of surprise me, but I would never have got it right at school.
Well, I certainly wouldn't have got it right. That's it for today. Sarah will be back with me tomorrow with more hay treats, including a green bean and mange tout salad, exclusively cooked for us in my kitchen by the green god of the kitchen, Jotam Ottolenghi.
That sounds delicious.